accurately measuring criminal behavior in the upper class was more than just an academic exercise, Sutherland made sure to explain. There were concrete costs and individual victims, and the general public paid a price for these crimes. He contended that the financial cost of white-collar crime was likely several times as great as the financial cost of all crimes, which are customarily included in the crime problem. By way of example, he noted that an officer of a grocery chain store embezzled, in 1 year, 6 times as much as the annual losses from 500 burglaries and robberies of the stores in that chain. Those costs are passed along to customers via higher prices. He was also concerned with the social impact of white-collar criminality. He believed that more so than street crime, white-collar crime creates distrust and produces social disorganization on a large scale. Sutherland's most controversial point was that when studying the crimes of the upper class, scholars should cast a net wider so as to capture more than just actual convictions by criminal courts. Toward this goal, he also wished to include in his definition of criminal behavior those unlawful actions by big business leaders that led to civil enforcement by government agencies. By way of example, he pointed to antitrust enforcement actions brought by the Federal Trade Commission. Using Sutherland's framework, I would label former Countrywide financial CEO Angelo Mozzillo a white-collar criminal in light of his $67 million settlement of civil fraud and insider trading charges with the SEC in 2010. The government accused him of relying on insider information when he made $140 million in profits selling stock in 2008. According to the SEC, Mozzillo also misled investors by claiming Countrywide was in good shape, falsely claiming that they had focused on making high-quality mortgage loans. In reality, as one SEC enforcement attorney explained, Mozzillo knew that Countrywide was gambling with increasingly risky mortgages, and he kept those details from investors while he was actively taking his own chips off the table. The settlement was small change for Mozzillo, who reportedly earned more than $500 million in the decade leading up to the crisis. Plus, Bank of America, which had purchased Countrywide, chipped in $45 million of the settlement as required under the indemnification provision in Countrywide's employment agreement with Mozzillo. As part of the deal, the SEC barred him from ever again serving as an officer or director of a public company. Mozzillo was by then 72. A few months later, the Justice Department decided to drop the criminal case against him. Similarly, Sutherland believed that convictability, not an actual conviction, should be the defining factor. He also suggested we count as criminal any potential conviction that was avoided merely because of pressure which is brought to bear on the court or substitute agency. While this might seem like a stretch, he reminded his listeners that night that addressing these unprosecuted acts was conventional practice when it came to studying mob activity. Gangsters and racketeers have been relatively immune in many cities because of their pressure on prospective witnesses and public officials. Yet, conventional criminologists do not hesitate to include the life histories of such criminals as data. The same approach should be used for high-status offenders. Sutherland also innovatively suggested that accessories to white-collar crimes who are not prosecuted should still be included when measuring the extent of criminality. Once again, he used precedent from street crime studies to support his argument. When the FBI investigates a kidnapping, he explained, it is not content with catching the offenders who carried away the victim. They may catch and the court may convict 25 other persons who assisted by secreting the victim, negotiating ransom, or putting the ransom money into circulation. In contrast, the prosecution of white-collar criminals frequently stops with one offender.